Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Dental care stopped except in emergencies when the coronavirus stay-at-home order began. Since the COVID-19 virus spread through droplets in the air or on surfaces, a dentist working in close proximity to a patient or even inside a patient's mouth were deemed too risky. However, the state has new guidelines for dentists to follow. Joining us is Dr. James Talberg, president of the Pennsylvania Dental Association. Dr. Talberg, welcome to the program.
And a good morning, and thank you for the kind welcome.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So I have a lot of questions about what's different now and reopening. But Dr. Talberg, let's take a step back. What couldn't dentists do while offices were shut down?
So if we start back to when the entire pandemic started, which was roughly early to mid-March, it was actually on, I believe, a Sunday, the 22nd of March, we received a order from the Pennsylvania Department of Health that basically had us shutting down for all patients unless we had what was called negative pressure air rooms. These are special rooms that are often found only in a hospital, and even then just one or two per hospital, if at all, that provide for a special type of airflow that you would use, for example, if someone had tuberculosis, a typical airborne, very contagious disease. There are no dental offices that have this kind of negative pressure airway. So for all practical purposes, dentistry was actually completely shut down in the state of Pennsylvania. It was about 5 days later when they finally changed a little bit and said you no longer had to have that unless you had an absolute patient who definitely had COVID-19. Otherwise, we were allowed to practice only to see what are called emergent or urgent cases. This was defined basically as severe pain, severe swelling, et cetera. At that time, we would only be able to see the patients after adequate screening of the patient and determination that they did not have COVID-19. We were allowed to do that with full PPE, social distancing, disinfection, et cetera. It went on like that basically until May the 8th. May the 8th, the Department of Health in Pennsylvania came out with a new standard, allowing us now to see more elective procedures, but again, using incidents of COVID as a guide, again, with full PPE, trying to use teledentistry, a way to do an exam ahead of time by virtual reality to determine does that patient really need the care at that time. We were also asked on the May 8th guidelines to defer anything that could be deferrable. So if you had a perfectly healthy mouth, you just come in for a six-month annual, semi-annual examination, but you have absolutely no type of inflammatory gum disease, a super low decay rate, and it's just a routine kind of, and I hate to use the word routine because nothing in medicine is ever routine, but a, let's call it a standard cleaning appointment, they were told us to defer those kind of appointments. So a lot of it was left up to the professional judgment and clinical acumen of the practitioner, and again, only with full PPE for everybody that was near the patient, along with disinfection and social standard and social distancing.
A couple of things you mentioned there that I have some questions about because they could be different for individual dentists and for individual patients. One is elective. What is elective? I mean, that seems like there's a wide disparity there in judgment by a dentist of what's elective and what's not. The second part of that question is everyone has a different level of pain. You said that the dentist would have to judge whether this is something that is painful enough for the patient to be seen in person. But let's start with the part about electives. What kind of electives procedures are we talking about?
So an elective procedure would be I'd like to have my teeth whitened. That's purely elective.
Okay.
I would love to have beautiful veneers on my teeth to make them look just gorgeous. That's absolutely elective.
Yeah, that's kind of an easy one, yeah.
Exactly. So those are elective procedures. And again, remember, this was Department of Health mandated to us. So this was not something that the dentist could say, I'm going to make that decision. That was somewhat, to some degree, made by the Department of Health for us. After that, it's all about professional and clinical judgment. So that was up to the dentist to determine for each individual patient. And that's why I said nothing in medicine is ever routine, because that does not exist. That word does not exist. Everybody is unique and has their own unique set of issues and problems and values, et cetera. So just as you said, everybody has a different pain threshold and pain reaction. That had to be determined by the dentist. Could that care be deferred by way of analgesics and antibiotics? Or was that care necessary to be done at that time? So that's the best way to describe that.
You said that one of the guidelines was, that one of the early guidelines was that a patient had to be COVID-19 free. How do you know that? I mean, one of the one of the characteristics of this is that there were so many people who didn't show symptoms, and if they hadn't been tested, how would you know if a patient didn't have COVID-19?
So just exactly the ambiguity of the Department of Health guidelines that we had to use, again, our professional judgment to get through. So according to the American Dental Association and the CDC, we have certain screening tools that we could use to make that determination. As you probably know, there is at least over 30% of all asymptomatic individuals that can still be COVID carriers. So there was no way to determine that exactly. And even as of now, dentists are still not allowed to order testing for COVID. So we have to do this all by screening, by evaluation, and then making the clinical determination. Bottom line is, today, the good news is, if you are going to an office that is properly equipped to do social distancing, disinfection, full PPE, and I mean full PPE, which we can talk about shortly if you'd like, it is about as safe a setting as it can be. Understand, dentistry has been doing our procedures for how many years? I think in the state of Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Dental Association had their 150th anniversary in 2018. So that's 153 years, at least in Pennsylvania, that dentistry has been practiced. Over the last 30-some years, ever since the HIV epidemic in the mid-80s, dentistry has been incredibly safe, and I'm sure you've heard very few medical problems coming from a dental office in terms of disease transmission, because we sterilize, we disinfect, we wear gloves, masks, protective eyewear. Many of us were wearing gowns or some type of protective uniform on top of scrubs. So in all honesty, it's already been safe. So what we're doing now is taking it up a notch. As you look at the medical world and those who are actually taking care of active COVID patients, as long as they're wearing all the full PPE these days, again, the risk of transmission seems to be incredibly small.
All right, let's talk a little bit about that. Treating dental patients would seem to be one of the more challenging things to do, considering that the virus is spread by droplets. How do you avoid those droplets coming out of a patient's mouth and landing on you or your equipment?
So first off, there's very little evidence through the Center for Disease Control, the CDC, on dental aerosols. Most aerosols coming from the mouth isn't just a fine mist, but rather, just as you point out, they're droplets. So certain droplets don't have the well-to-be hanging in the air, and they just simply immediately fall to the ground. In other words, based on the size of the droplet and the weight. But you bring up a very good point. There is no evidence right now or study that actually shows how that actually works. So what we do currently in our offices are we try to do procedures that are minimal aerosol. If one does have to aerosol, we use what's called four-handed dentistry. You have an assistant and a doctor with appropriate suction devices. Many offices have included some type of air filtration, though that is not yet an official CDC guideline, to, again, try to remove any possible contaminant from the environment. With these in mind, also a pre-dental rinse to reduce the population of viruses and or bacteria in the mouth. At this point, it's actually reasonably safe. But again, no definitive information yet from the CDC on that exactly.
And I'm just going to follow up on what you said and repeat some of what you just said, but this is coming from the CDC, and from what I understand, the directive from the Department of Health said to follow Centers for Disease Control guidelines. This is a direct quote. Avoid aerosol-generating procedures whenever possible. Avoid the use of dental handpieces and the air-water syringe. Use of ultrasonic scalers is not recommended. Prioritize minimally invasive, atraumatic, restorative techniques, hand instruments only. Okay, for those of us who are not familiar with, being in a dental, we've been on a patient side, but on your side, when you hear that, what does that mean?
So the idea is, again, they're guidelines, and they're not definitive. As per the Department of Health and Governor Wolf here in Pennsylvania, they realize that there are unique characteristics in dental settings. And so, again, we've been asked to, regardless of the degree of any kind of community spread, a dental healthcare practitioner should practice universal source control, actively screen for fever and symptoms of COVID-19. Again, we've been asked to assess the risk of that particular patient. Could care still be deferred or minimized or done without an aerosol? However, if you must do a procedure that requires an aerosol, then you make sure you have, again, your personal protection equipment, your PPE, and the supplies to support the patient volume, to protect the staff, to protect the doctor, and, of course, to protect the public, most importantly. So you use CDC guidance, not rules, guidance, to help determine what is the proper care and what is the best way to take care of that patient. And that's how it works. Otherwise, let me see if I can read this to you exactly here.
Well, while you're doing that, let me just ask the follow-up question on this. What is an aerosol-generating procedure? Give us an example.
So you go to the dentist and you need to have something where they're using a dental drill to take care of a procedure. Therefore, you now have some type of aerosol because there's an air-water spray.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
You are having your teeth cleaned with an ultrasonic device. There is a little air-water spray. Again, if there's droplets because it's a water spray, does that actually aerosol and go out into the environment, or does it simply drop down? There have been some studies, though not yet published, showing that in general the splatter, and they've used dye studies for this, show that the splatter immediately falls down. So it's not really up in the air in a true aerosol per se. It's just that there has never been research done to definitively say yay or nay. In summation, the new guidance basically says that dental professionals statewide can perform pretty much any procedure, including dental cleanings, provided they do what is appropriate for healthcare professionals to do under any circumstance, which is evaluate all the relative factors affecting the overall health of their patients before making decisions about how to best deliver care that will help their patients achieve and maintain good oral health. And then you have to deliver that care in a manner that is safe for both the patient and all the dental team members. I think as long as we do that, we're doing everything humanly possible to make oral health care safe, and you must have oral health care. If not, as you pointed out, I think, earlier in our conversation, there's different levels of pain, infection, decay, gum disease. That all has to be taken care of. It actually is a harbinger of general systemic health, so you need to know that.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Be sure to tune in tomorrow's program. We have Pennsylvania Secretary of Education Pedro Rivera on the program. He's been talking a lot, as we know more, about how schools will look, when classes will start, what the classroom will look like, how many students in a classroom, all those kind of things we'll be talking about with Secretary Rivera coming up on tomorrow's program. During this portion of today's show, we're talking with Dr. James Talberg, President president of the Pennsylvania Dental Association, talking about what the dentist office may look like. Well, it looks like right now, some of the changes that have been made, some of the precautions have been taken to stop the spread of the coronavirus. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Talberg, there have been some reports that there will be dentists who will charge a PPE fee. Will they?
It's based on each individual practice and their practice decision. Now, dentists have been using PPE, as I said, since the mid-80s. Prior to that, it was just not part of our training. But by the mid-80s and the HIV, again, everybody was now disinfecting, sterilizing, wearing glove, mask, protective eyewear, et cetera. So when we were doing that up until, let's say, about 120 days ago, with literally no disease transmission that anybody is aware of nationwide from dentistry, with the advent of the COVID-19 crisis, we had to take it to the next step. Unfortunately, two things occurred basically in Pennsylvania. One, the Department of Health and PEMA, which is the state-mandated portion of FEMA, which is the Federal Emergency Management Agency, we are not under priority to receive our PPE, meaning we don't get it from a federal source or even from a state source. So we have been told basically by the Department of Health and PEMA in Pennsylvania that we must source our PPE on our own, which means we have to go to the open market and find PPE, especially now that so much of the United States is reopening again, and especially in Pennsylvania. You can imagine that PPE is in super high demand. In a dental office, one needs to have, and we'll start from top to the bottom, so you need to have many people will wear some type of head covering to protect their hair. They will then wear a face shield. They'll add a special type of respiratory mask called an N95, or from a foreign country, they're called KN95s. They are special filtration masks that seal around the mouth. Often we'll wear a secondary mask on top of that to protect our N95s, because if they become in any way or form visibly soiled or wet, they no longer filter properly. We will have some type of protective gown on now. And also we may have, besides our gloves, we will also have some type of shoe covering on. The price of that has gone probably about anywhere from 300% to literally 1,000% on everything we buy from PPE. Wow. So what used to cost us a matter of maybe $3 to provide for a patient now might cost each individual for each patient encounter $30 or more.
So what does that look like to an actual patient as far as what's being added to their bill?
Well, first off, they should be told when they're making their appointment that there is going to be a PPE charge, personal protection equipment charge, and what that charge may be. At the current time, I'm aware of only one dental insurer in Pennsylvania that is willing to pay for some PPE, and even then, they're telling us that by July 31st, they're no longer going to pay for that. The amount that they do pay, as I told you already, the numbers that typically it costs to equip us with PPE is so small that it really doesn't even pay for the PPE. Unfortunately, with many dental third-party benefit companies, dental insurance, if you will, the deal is that they pay a greatly discounted rate from whatever the actual charge really is. So if they do the same thing for PPE, again, we can't afford to buy the PPE to provide the proper care. So in many offices, sometimes they'll be able to charge a PPE fee, or they might raise their fees if they're fee-for-service. If they're third-party benefit questions, that's where the issue becomes, because if you're already working on discounted rates and then you're being told, yes, you can't charge for PPE by the third-party carrier if you participate, or if that fee is so small that you basically are losing money every single time, that's a mathematical problem.
You know, I know this sounds like an editorialized question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Please.
When we when we establish right up front that there is the potential to spread this virus because you were in so close proximity, and you know, you've talked about all the preparation that has been made and has been ordered to be made, why wouldn't dental or oral care be a priority when it comes to PPE?
In Pennsylvania?
Yeah.
Well, believe it or not, we are number four on the list. So number one is hospitals, then nursing homes, then frontline providers.
Okay, number I can't argue with that. Go ahead.
Right. Number four, dentistry. Now that's at the FEMA national level. In Pennsylvania, my understanding is, in speaking to the Department of Health and PEMA, is that they're still having difficulty getting enough PPE just to take care of the number one, two, and three. So for that reason, right now, in Pennsylvania, we are not prioritized.
Well, I mean, I'm being sympathetic to the challenge that you're facing here. I'm just looking at it when dental care or oral care is not considered a priority. Now, I understand the other three that are ahead. So, you know, but still, you would think that it would be a little bit. I know that it is very difficult today to get PPE equipment, but you just think this would be more of a priority.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I apologize.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, the Secretary of Health, Dr. Rachel Levine, actually was quoted as saying oral health is a key part of one's overall health, and we strongly encourage all Pennsylvanians to regularly see a dentist and receive oral health care. So they know that, and they know that dentists should prioritize dental care for the highest need and most vulnerable patients first. So the Department of Health recognizes this. I think their problem is they just don't have an adequate supply themselves, and therefore we're just falling off the priority scale.
There are a lot of people who are out of work and do not have incomes, do not have their dental insurance. Have dentists around the state come up with any kind of different payment options with so many out of work, so many people hurting financially?
I believe every dental office has made some kind of arrangement for people. We recognize that people need oral health. And so depending on the office, there are a variety of different ways to take care of oral health care needs.
I want to take a step back and talk more about some of the procedures. You mentioned teledentistry.
Sure.
We've heard a whole lot about telemedicine, but how does teledentistry work?
So teledentistry works, of course, it's an online virtual format where you can actually see the patient can see the doctor, and we can now talk about what is going on, what their needs are. So that's almost something you could do by telephone. In addition, though, now we can actually perform to some degree an inspection. We can actually look at the patient. So if the patient says, here's my decayed tooth, and kind of holds out their cheek to show you that or show you a swelling, it gives you a little better idea. But obviously it's limited because all you can do is do an inspection. When you go to the dentist, they palpate, meaning they touch to determine what else is going on. They probe both the gums and the teeth. They percuss the teeth, meaning they tap on the teeth. They take x-rays, so you can only do just that little tiny bit. So it's really a screening tool. It is no substitute for a proper dental examination.
I mean, could it be considered or is it considered triage?
It would be definitely triage, absolute triage. And triage, I think, today is performed by most dental offices either by telephone or by teledentistry.
So other than dental symptom questions, you kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, but what questions are being asked now of patients before they even come into the office?
Sure. Hold on, and I'll give you the exact list because I don't want to misquote myself from my own memorization because we actually run it off a script here. Questions such as, do you have a fever? Or have you recently felt hot or feverishly recently in the last 14 to 21 days? Are you having shortness of breath or other difficulties breathing? Do you have a cough? Any other flu-like symptoms such as GI upset, headache, fatigue? Have you experienced a recent loss of taste or smell? Have they been in contact with any confirmed COVID-19 positive patients? Is there a sick family member at home who may be considered COVID-19 positive, or are you currently being tested for COVID-19? Is your age over 60, which seems to be a little higher risk in the elderly population? Do you have any kind of heart disease, lung disease, kidney disease, diabetes, or autoimmune disorders? And have you traveled in the past 14 days to any regions with a high COVID-19 incidence? So those are some of the questions we use as screening tools ahead of time. And we ask them that when they make the appointment. When they get to the office, we ask them, if possible, either wait in the car before we bring you up to the office, and we'll call and redo the screening questions. When they come in the office, we'll, again, believe it or not, ask the screening questions one more time. We'll actually do a temperature check. We'll give them, if they don't have a mask already, which we ask them to please come to the office with a mask, we will provide a mask. We ask them to hand wash or hand sanitize, and then they're brought back into the office. Only when they get back in the chair do they actually take off their mask to provide the exam or the care. Otherwise, the mask goes back on. We have them re-sanitize their hands, and they are dismissed back out to the through the front door.
So waiting rooms are going to be much different, especially like toys or, you know, those highlight magazines that kids used to see in the dentist office.
I feel very bad because I used to pride myself on having the most current magazines. Don't you hate going to the doctor's office and the magazine is 2 years old?
Yeah,
are you kidding me? So I always had the most absolute perfect. I must have 10 brand new magazines every month, always changed. Gone. All the magazines are gone. Toys are gone. Pictures are gone. It's pretty plain office now. And I actually had to change all my chairs. I had chairs that had beautiful cloth seats and wooden handles, all removed. I now have vinyl chairs that are vinyl with metal that can all be disinfected and wiped down very carefully. Waiting rooms will become, to some degree, a bit superfluous, and if you are sitting in a waiting room, you have to have 6 feet distancing. In general, we prefer only the patient to come into the office at this current time. If there is an escort, we ask them to please, again, wait in the hallway or wait out in the car. We'll invite them back up as soon as we can possibly do so when the patient is actually finished. If there is a need for somebody to be in a waiting room, such as a parent of a child, somebody who is the escort of a special needs person, et cetera, then we, of course, will have them in the waiting room with a mask on, and when they're out, we got to disinfect the whole office again, especially the waiting room.
Well, that was my next question. What do you do after the patient leaves?
So if there's different parts of the office, so if we're out in a waiting room or in a front desk, we simply wipe down, disinfect anywhere else they could possibly be. In the actual operatory, once we're done, we have to wait about 15 minutes just to make double sure that there's no other aerosols, as we talked about, everything has settled. Then we disinfect the office completely with appropriate CDC-suggested disinfectant. I in some offices, they've gone extra steps. Again, I have air filtration units in my office that actually filter down to 0.003 microns. The smallest size for this virus, they say, is 0.6 microns. So my filters are definitely filtering out that virus. And we have multiple ones, 5 units in a small 800-square-foot office. Each unit can do a 900-square-foot office 4 times an hour. I got 5 in the office running. In addition, some offices will do ultraviolet radiation, which has also been shown in some studies to be a reasonable disinfectant. Other offices will use a hydrochloric acid fogger. Hydrochloric acid is made with salt and water, and basically it is as powerful as bleach as a disinfectant. It's been used in the hospital industry and the restaurant industry. Believe it or not, it's even used in low concentration in eye drops, so it's incredibly safe stuff. It's just salt and water. And some people will fog their rooms in between patients and allow that to settle too and dry rapidly. So there's all kinds of different methods that dentists are using. Some are using all the methods, some are using some of the methods. But no matter what, we definitely have to wait 15 minutes after seeing a patient, then disinfect, and then wait at least another 15 minutes.
So, final question, Dr. Talberg.
Sure.
Can a patient get an appointment now? I imagine that there is a backup with offices being closed for a couple months.
The American Dental Association yesterday said about 75% of offices around the country are now open. My office actually opens up on Monday. We're still practicing and making sure everything is just dead center perfect. We don't want anybody to have any kind of potential exposure, so we want to make sure it's just perfect. But the answer is yes, you can, but there is a backlog of almost 12 weeks of patients. Plus, as I just said, since you're disinfecting offices and social distancing, where we could see a patient in an hour, maybe that patient time now is an hour and a half. So we can't see as many patients as we once did.
Mm. Dr. James Talberg is president of the Pennsylvania Dental Association. I learned a lot today, Dr. Talberg. Thank you very much for being with us today.
It is my pleasure. Have a really great day.
Thank you. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. For more information on dental care and oral health, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. As you heard in our last segment, routine dental procedures stopped during the coronavirus pandemic and just recently began to ramp up. For many Pennsylvanians, the pandemic wasn't what was stopping them from receiving dental care. Access is a major issue in the state. For example, all but four Pennsylvania counties have been designated as dental provider shortage areas, and about a quarter of the state's dentists, only about a quarter of the state's dentists, accept Medicaid or Medicare insurance for payment. To talk about access and some other issues having to do with dental care, our guest, Helen Hawkey, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Coalition for Oral Health. Ms. Hawkey, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. Happy to be here.
And Kelly Braun, the Dental Delivery Systems Coordinator for the Pennsylvania Office of Rural Health, which is part of Penn State University. Kelly Braun, glad to have you on today's program.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So talking about access to dental care, and especially for children here in Pennsylvania, both of you can weigh in on this if you'd like. How significant of an issue is this access to dental care or oral health here in Pennsylvania?
Well, Scott, I think that one of the things that we've really, when we think about access and we think about just the sheer numbers game, particularly, you know, you mentioned the fact that only less than 25% of general dentists accept Medicaid in our state. When we look at the exact same numbers for medical providers and primary care physicians, we know that that number goes to about 85 to 90%. So we're talking about the exact same number of children enrolled in Medicaid that have a quarter of the amount of providers to see when it comes to dental. And I know Kelly can speak to the traveling and the issues that we see in the rural parts of Pennsylvania as well.
But Helen, before we get to that, why is that? I mean, why is there such a disparity between medical doctors accepting Medicaid and Medicare and dentists doing it?
Well, there's a lot of theories behind that. A lot of folks think that it has a lot to do with the Medicaid fee schedule that's set by the Department of Human Services in Pennsylvania. So, you know, the last study that was done back in 2014, I believe, showed about that the Medicaid rates pay about 40% of what private insurances would. Now, for children, it's a little more of an equal payment system. But at the same time, it just becomes an issue where, the sheer numbers, we've sort of not hit that tipping point. If every office in the state would accept Medicaid, we wouldn't have, maybe 10,000 enrollees of Medicaid heading to one office. So it's just sort of that really trying to get that division. If tomorrow 90% of dentists accepted Medicaid, then it would be economically feasible for all the offices to work with a lower fee schedule.
Kelly Braun, when we're talking about low income, especially children, there is a difference between access in rural and urban settings. Talk about that, if you would.
There absolutely is a difference in access. So urban dentist supply is nearly double that of the rural dentist supply. And actually 48 of our 67 counties in Pennsylvania are considered to be rural counties. So when we think about that, you know, twice the dentists are concentrated in those urban areas. We have a very large rural portion geographically in the state. And so that leads us to traveling long distances to access care. When we look at the supply of dentists in 2015, we had 33.6 dentists per 100,000 residents in rural counties, as compared to 52.1 dentists per 100,000 residents in urban counties. So you can see the disparity in those numbers.
So are low-income children in urban areas getting the dental care they need?
Not necessarily. They're more likely to get the dental care they need, but just because there are more dentists doesn't necessarily mean that the children that need the care are getting to the care.
So in rural areas, we definitely know that there are too many children who aren't getting the kind of dental care they need, correct?
That's correct. And transportation has a lot to do with that, as well as, you know, the provider supply in rural areas.
What is the provider supply? I mentioned, and this was a statistic that came from your study, that all but four Pennsylvania counties have been designated as dental provider shortage areas. And one of you quoted the ratio of dentists to population. But what are those numbers? What do they mean to us?
So I have go ahead, Helen.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, one of the things that we look at is the dental health professional shortage area maintains that it's a 5,000 to 1 patient to provider ratio. So that's really what we're looking at if we're trying to determine that. And so it's nearly 2 million individuals in the state that reside in a dental health professional shortage area. And so the Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA, has determined that in order to get the appropriate number of providers in Pennsylvania, and this would be in specific areas, we would need 277 new dentists to come into the state to meet the shortage areas.
And I understand that there are a lot of dentists that are retiring, correct?
Yes. Yeah. One of the same study that Kelly mentioned, the workforce survey that was done with relicensure back in 2015, demonstrated approximately 27% of the dentists that were licensed in the state at that time were planning to retire within the next 6 years. So fast forward, here we are 5.5 years later. You know, we're very concerned that we know the numbers are going down, and we're also very concerned that COVID is going to sort of spin that a little faster. So, you know, if a doctor was practicing and sort of had plans to retire in the next year or two, who now has had, you know, the office shut down with no revenue for, you know, a few months, it might be a much easier decision to just go ahead and retire now. So the Pennsylvania Coalition for Oral Health is actually tracking that. We have a survey going out this week to all dentists in the state, so that we can determine where there might be some hot spots of vacancies, you know, where dentists have decided to close their doors permanently or retire.
But aren't there enough new dentists to take the place of those retiring?
Not according to the numbers that we see. With Pennsylvania's three full-time dental schools, you know, we see less than 500 students graduate annually. And when we look at the individual demographics for those schools, we know that about half of those students are typically from out of state. So they tend to go back to the states that they're from. They don't stay in Pennsylvania. And so what we have discovered is that we really need to start sort of guiding students, even as soon as high school, into dental careers if they're from a rural area or an underserved area, because that's sort of the way to rebuild the pipeline. You know, a dentist from Perry County typically, you know, might have grown up in Perry County, and that's why they choose to practice there.
Well, you see, that was one of the questions. My next question is, if you have someone who, say, didn't grow up in Perry County or another rural county in Pennsylvania, I understand that Forest County, for example, just a few years ago, I don't know if it's still accurate or not, but didn't have one dentist that accepted Medicaid or Medicare, or at least Medicaid, I should say. I'm not sure about Medicare, but Medicaid. So what would motivate someone just graduating from dental school to go to a place like a Forest County or another rural county in Pennsylvania?
So Forest County actually, as of 2017, did not have any dentists in the county.
Okay.
There was nobody to provide services there, whether or not they were taking insurances. So there are some loan repayment programs that are meant to help place providers in areas that have shortage issues and support them through that decision. So in return for their service to that area that is underserved, they would receive some loan repayment. So that is one method that is available to try to place providers in areas where they're most needed.
That's what I was anticipating, was that there would be some kind of program like that, as is becoming a little more common with a lot of professions where there are so few professionals in rural areas like that. I want to talk a little bit about dental care and school. Is it accurate to say that the only pathway for some low-income rural students to dental care is through their school? Is that accurate?
And I'm sure Kelly can address this somewhat, but I would say maybe 30 years ago when we had schools can have either a mandated dental program or a dental hygiene services program, which is where they actually employ a dental hygienist. And those programs were extremely popular a few decades ago. But with school funding cuts and taxes and issues like that, now out of the 500 school districts in Pennsylvania, I believe for the 1920 school year, we had 36 that had a dental hygienist on staff. The rest of them just have a school dentist who comes in to do the mandated screenings, but doesn't necessarily do any follow-up or help connect that child to dental care. So we really would love to see sort of a resurgence in those dental hygiene services programs where we could get a dedicated staff person in the school to follow up, to do the wellness, well checks, to follow up with CYS, to find a dentist, a dental home for those children. It's definitely a big issue.
Go ahead, Kelly.
I was just going to say it's important to note that the dental screenings for the mandated dental program are only required for 3 grades. So it's upon entry into school, whether that be kindergarten or first grade, and then in 3rd grade and 7th grade. So those in-between grades may actually sort of fall through the cracks if the school is with a mandated dental program. Those children don't necessarily have to have dental screenings during those years.
Well, it may surprise some people that the percentage may surprise how low it is, but considering that there are so many school districts in this state that or schools that don't have a nurse in this school, and those things have become probably as a result of what Helen said, with taxes and budget cuts and that kind of thing. But it makes the point that dental care is such an important part of health care. Do we as a society understand that or realize that?
I think we're starting to, and I think that we're seeing a pretty, there's a common phrase in the oral health world that, we want to put the mouth back into the body. And for years and years and years, the mouth has been outside of the body. So let's get it back in and let's start talking about the mouth as part of our overall health care. The other side of it, too, is, we now, and it has been the recommendation for many years, but it's definitely becoming more well known that children really need to be in a dental home connected to a dentist by age 1. That's really, if dental disease is all about prevention. So we're seeing sort of a shift in this surgical management of dental disease, which would be, the drill and fill mentality, to how do we, not just treat the disease that's already occurred, how do we prevent that disease from actually happening? And that doesn't work unless we get those kids into the office at age 1, we educate the family, we educate the kids, and we can actually provide treatments at that time that prevent dental disease from ever even occurring. And I think that's really where, you know, just like, you know, a patient with high blood pressure doesn't wait until they have a heart attack to get treatment. They stop and they cut salt out of their diet, you know, as soon as they know they have high blood pressure.
What do you look for in a one-year-old?
Well, a lot of a one-year-old visit is about educating mom and dad. So we want to make sure that the bacteria that end up taking up shop in the mouth are the right kind of bacteria. So we encourage parents not to share swap spit with their babies. We look for any brown spots or early decay. We look at things like diet. We look at non-nutritive sucking habits, so pacifier use. Discontinuing the use of a bottle by age one. There's a ton of things that can sort of happen with a one-year-old that doesn't necessarily fit that whole sit in the chair and have a procedure done. It's definitely more about educating the parents in how to bring up their children with a much lower chance of having any dental disease.
A pacifier bad for a child's oral health?
Well, if it's used too much, it is. We always, and I think I'd probably get some disagreement on this, but I prefer pacifier over a thumb because you can take away a pacifier. So if a baby has that really strong need, sometimes a pacifier can be good. It just has to be used at the right time and taken away at the right time.
See, I throw these questions in because I just get curious when I hear these things. But it does bring up another point when we're talking about a shortage of dentists across the state. Pediatric dentists are in short supply as well, aren't they?
Yes, definitely. Kelly, you have probably some better statistics on that.
Pediatric dentists, again, especially in rural counties, finding specialties is very difficult. So you might find a general dentist. But to find that specialty, usually patients are having to travel to a more urban area to receive that care. We do have medical offices helping us out as well. So we know that young patients are more prone to see their medical provider more frequently than a dental provider. And so in those first few visits, those first few child well visits after a baby is born, the medical providers are being trained to have conversations with mom and dad about the child's oral health, and to actually steer them to a dentist and help to connect them to that dental care.
You know, we've been talking a lot about kids, but what about adults, and especially in rural areas? I mean, this is not just a child issue. It's very important for young people, but at the same time, we adults have to keep their teeth and their gums and maintain their mental health their oral health as well. What are some of the challenges that adult patients face?
So what we've seen, particularly with adults that are enrolled in Medicaid, is that it's not a full gamut of procedures that adults can have under Medicaid. And so what happens is that if they're able to find a provider who accepts their insurance, that provider sort of may have their hands tied as to what procedures they can do. And so, you know, what we see kind of come out of that is that adults aren't necessarily seeking out dental care, which then has this multi-generational effect of, you know, if the parents aren't going to a dentist on a regular basis, they're not taking their kids either. And then adults who aren't getting regular dental care, who have maybe more aesthetic problems in how their teeth look, we find that they are much less employable. So, you know, it has a lot of sort of economic effects to, just a person not getting dental care really affects everything. It affects their self-esteem, their employability, their overall health, and then maybe also their children's health as well.
What percentage of Pennsylvanians have dental insurance?
That's a loaded question. The last statistics, I don't know if Kelly has anything better than what I have seen, but the last statistics that I've seen are probably somewhere in the 60 to 70% range.
Mm-hmm. And
Kelly, would you agree with that?
I would. And that's not to say that it covers all services. I mean, there's generally still out-of-pocket costs with that insurance.
Right. And with so many people get their dental insurance through their employer, with so many people during this pandemic losing their jobs, I'm sure that's going to be an issue. We only have a minute or so left. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. So the question is, what's the answer to this? What kind of advice would you impart on our audience?
Well, I think that, you know, maintaining routine care, finding a dental home is very, very important. We know not everybody gets there every year, and we'd love to see that change. But there are also things that communities can do, efforts like community water fluoridation, you know, where residents can get optimally fluoridated water. So that helps their teeth. That helps adults and children. You know, talking to their physicians about their oral health if they can't find a dental provider. And really just is, you know, utilizing the best home care that they can, taking care of their teeth at home with all your typical, you know, ways of brushing and flossing and mouth rinse. Kelly, anything else to add?
Not at all. You covered it. Thank you.
Helen Hawkey is Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Coalition for Oral Health, and Kelly Braun, the Dental Delivery Systems Coordinator for the Pennsylvania Office of Rural Health. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, Pennsylvania Secretary of Education, Dr. Pedro Rivera, will be with us.